You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Boisson. Coming up, childhood trauma is in the news as the House Oversight Committee reviews kids being separated from their parents at the border today. We talk about the lasting effects early trauma can have later in life. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. We're checking in with reporters from around the state about the stories they've been covering. First, when a paper mill in northern Wisconsin's Park Falls shut down this last month, it put about 180 employees out of work. But now a new arrangement is calling back some of those workers as early as next week. Rob Menser is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Judith. Happy Friday.
To you, too. So why did the mill shut down last month?
So this is a mill, Flambeau Rivers Paper, that is in receivership right now, sort of in a bankruptcy process and is being operated by a receiver as they are seeking a buyer. It's going to go up for auction. So they were having problems. They had shut down a couple of their paper machines, and they had an issue with a buyer. And what happened was early this month, a deal was approved in court between the mill and a buyer who has agreed to buy a bunch of their product, about 75 tons per day of this pulp product. And that agreement is good enough for them to reopen the mill.
And is that the product that they were producing before it was shut down?
Well, so they produced several, you know, different sorts of things. At one time, the primary product of this mill was white copy paper, and that is not the business that you want to be in anymore. So the mill has capacity to do some like specialty packaging products, of food grade packaging products, but its main product right now is essentially this wood pulp product that they actually sell to other mills that use it as raw material and can process it in different ways.
A lot of paper mills are or were key parts of their cities and towns. Can you tell us about the role that this plant plays in Park Falls?
So this mill has existed since 1896. And it is absolutely central to Park Falls. Is this Northwoods town of about 2,500 people, and for sure it is organized around the mill. It's not the only game in town. There are other manufacturing companies. There are other major employers there. But I spoke to the mayor of Park Falls, Michael Boblick, and the way he explained it was that mill, because those are relatively high paying jobs, creates, you know, an upward wage pressure for all the other employers around there.
And Rob, as we said, the mill is still looking for a new buyer. This is a short-term plan. What do the prospects look like for making that sale happen?
Well, so, you know, Boblick, first of all, he said he has spoken himself to multiple parties that are interested in buying the mill. And his view was he said to me, if nobody was interested in buying it, there'd be no point in reopening it. And so that's sort of the broader way to see this, is that keeping the mill running is a way to make it more attractive to potential buyers. And we may know more about that in probably late August, I think, is when the auction is scheduled.
Great. Well, we will check back in with you then. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Menser is WPR's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He talked with us about a short-term deal that's restarting operations at a Park Falls paper mill. Now we head to Port Washington for an update on a financial scam that targeted one of the city's parishes. In March, more than $500,000 was stolen, but since then, a lot of that money has been recovered. Kristen Halbig-Zeem is the Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
First, can you remind us how this parish, St. John the 23rd, was scammed out of $500,000 in the spring?
Well, it all started. The parish is doing a construction project. They're expanding their school, and they received an email from a company purporting to be their general contractor, saying, "Hey, we just switched banks. So when you send us our payments, send it to this account at this bank." And a few days later, they received a phone call from a woman saying, "Hey, we just want to make sure you got our email because we just switched this." And Parrish said, "Sure." And so that when their bill came, $510,000, they sent the payment to the new bank. And about a week or so later, they got information that it was a fraudulent account and their money was gone.
And the good news is almost $300,000 of that has been recovered. How has the parish gotten that money back?
Well, it's a pretty amazing story because nobody really expected they'd ever get any of it back. When this all happened, obviously they reported it to local police, who then got some of the federal authorities involved. The FBI, the Attorney General's office, and ultimately the IRS looked into this. And the IRS was able to track the bank accounts and managed to track down roughly $140,000 that they recovered and sent to the parish. In addition, the umbrella insurance for the Archdiocese paid another $165,000 roughly. So all in all, the parish has gotten back already about $290,000.
And the last time we talked with you, when you first told us about this story, you mentioned that one parish member described the scam as being like, quote, a punch in the gut. What are you hearing now that 60% of the money has actually been refunded or recovered?
They're just extremely thankful and relieved. And they have received some indications that more money may be forthcoming, both from recovery and from insurance. So they're hopeful that everything will ultimately be covered and it won't cost the parish any more money.
And so the project for the school, is that back on track now?
It is. It's been ongoing. The contractor, instead of requiring the payment when it was originally due, has now asked the parish to pay it by August. So they're able to make the payment. As they've gotten the money, they've made the payments. And they're expecting more money, hoping for more money, so they should be on track with that. The construction itself is moving along, and the school should be open for the new year.
Wow, well, a surprisingly positive update on this story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us, Chris.
Thank you.
Kristen Halbig-Zeem is the Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. She talked with us about how one of the city's parishes is recovering money it was scammed out of earlier this year. Finally, Governor Tony Evers was in Kenosha County yesterday for the announcement of a new drug-making facility. Nexus Pharmaceuticals plans to spend $250 million on a plant in the village of Pleasant Prairie. Corey Hess is a reporter for WPR News based in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly does Nexus Pharmaceuticals have planned for this new project in Pleasant Prairie?
Well, what they're going to do is build their first manufacturing plant. They've been outsourcing manufacturing, and they plan to put a sterile drug plant in Pleasant Prairie.
And what kind of timeline are we looking at for the project?
Well, this is going to be a multi-phase project. So their first phase is going to be done, they're hoping by 2022, and that's going to bring 77 jobs. It's going to have two manufacturing lines.
And so that's the first stage. How long will it be until the entire project is up and running?
They think about 10 years for the entire project. That will have six manufacturing lines. And in talking to the CEO, she says that it could have up to 300 jobs when all is said and done.
And what do we know about the level of tax incentives, if any, that Nexus is getting from the state for this project?
They are getting tax incentives. WEDC, which is the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which authorizes tax incentives, they've approved up to $1.5 million for tax incentives over the next 4 years. This is dependent on if Nexus does produce the jobs that they've promised and also the build-out that they've said they're going to do.
And finally, Corey, this isn't the only company that's planning to expand into the Kenosha County area. What other developments are on the table?
Yeah, not at all. You know, Kenosha County has a lot of land, and that's what attracted Nexus. Haribo, which is a German candy maker, they are in the process of building a facility, and that could bring 400 jobs. Uline has really invested a lot in Pleasant Prairie. They've got several million square feet. Also, Amazon, if anyone's driven down there, has seen the large Amazon distribution center. So, I mean, a lot of companies have expanded in Kenosha County.
Well, Corey, thanks so much for giving us the details.
Thank you.
Corey Hess is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked with us about a production facility that Nexus Pharmaceuticals is planning to build in Pleasant Prairie. Coming up, we learn how childhood trauma can have lasting effects as people age. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wants to take another look at what we mean when we use the phrase unalienable rights. We'll ask a constitutional law expert about that and talk about whether the definition has changed over time. First, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform met today for a hearing. They're looking at the Trump administration's policy of separating immigrant children from their parents at the southern border as a means of deterring more asylum seekers.
Separating children from their mothers and fathers causes damage that may endure for a lifetime. Let me let that sink in. In other words, until they die.
That was Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings, a Democrat from Maryland. He went on to say the committee has just begun to receive more information about the separations from the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services after they sent those agencies subpoenas. Chairman Cummings said they've learned that at least 18 infants and toddlers under 2 years old have been taken from their immigrant parents at the border and kept apart for up to 6 months. And at least 241 separated children were kept in Border Patrol facilities longer than the 72 hours permitted by law. We wanted to learn more about the effects this kind of trauma can have on a child. And we have Pam McGranahan here in the studio to talk more about it. Pam is a nurse practitioner, associate clinical professor at UW, and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at UW's School of Nursing. She spends a lot of time researching and working on the effects of trauma and adverse childhood experiences. Pam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about what happens to a child when they are separated from their parents for extended periods, as we're seeing?
Some of it depends on the age of the child, but in almost all cases, it's a devastating thing to do. And any parent who imagines that, having a child forcibly taken away from them, especially if we don't know the environment they're going into, that it is nurturing and safe and predictable, that is a really horrifying thought.
And you said it depends a little on the age of the child. What kind of differences do we see, say, between those toddlers or maybe elementary school age kids, early teens?
It is hard to quantify. You know, there are a lot of depends in this whole saga. But we do know that in those first 3 years, it's critical that a child has a predictable, safe adult who responds to them roughly the same way. Any of us who've raised a baby knows that when they squeal, you know, we look at them and say, oh, what noise you're making, right? That child matters to me. And in that way, it's called serve and return. They give us a cue, we respond back to it, and they start learning about their impact on the world. So brains aren't cooked when babies are born, and they build from the bottom up. And so all of those interactions that we have almost instinctively with children as safe and loving adults that think that child is the center of our world is what puts a brain together for a lifetime of productivity and coping and the ability to attach to other people around them and care about the world.
So that sounds a lot of emotional and psychological impacts. Are there also other, obviously the brain is part of our physical being too, but are there other physical impacts that we might see?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time about how to talk about this on radio in just a few minutes today. So in 2007, Jack Shonkoff from the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a really great technical brief that talked about the complexity of childhood development. And it's dependent. For one thing, we learn. It's how our brain is built and how it learns. And some of that's really physiological, the way the cells attach, our neurons. But then there are also environmental, like how well we're fed, how safe our environment is in terms of chemical exposures that can really change how children develop. Communicable disease is a piece of that. We know that there's a stress reaction that is really more of our hormone system that raises our cortisol levels, which is hard on brain development, but also really hard on our cardiovascular system. And so there's some stress piece that occurs both in who's nurturing us, how we're being fed and taken care of physically, and then in just how stressed we are and the opportunities that are afforded to us. So this really complex, we refer to it as the environment, but it is really about relationships and food and chemical exposures, as well as how safe or stressed we feel. all contribute to building a baby's brain into a productive adult.
We heard Representative Cummings say that damage from childhood trauma, like being separated from parents, can last into adulthood, potentially for an entire lifetime. Is that an accurate assessment?
It is accurate, and that's actually where my interest lies. So I came out of, I've been a nurse for more than three decades, and came out of public health and really had an interest in, we used to talk about upstream determinants. We still do, but I've really narrowed my view down. In looking at adult health, why are some adults not as healthy as others? And cardiovascular disease is really linked to things that happened to you as a child, and it's that inflammation again. And I don't ever want to leave people feeling hopeless. There are things you can do. The lever is really probably epigenetic on top of that elevated cortisol. And so I always say love, mindfulness, and kale can heal a lot. But I see no reason to inflict damage on children when we can avoid it.
And is there a difference? I'm guessing there is, but how big a difference is it between being separated for, say, that 72 hours, which is allowable by law, versus several months?
Oh, none of it's good. I don't want to get political in this, but it's never a good idea to forcibly separate primary caregiver and an infant or a child. But 72 hours is a whole lot better than months or weeks. And, you know, anybody who has children or has been around children recognizes they have no capacity to understand that and to separate it from abandonment. And so that's a whole different set of behavioral impacts.
Pam McGranahan is a nurse practitioner, associate clinical professor at UW, and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at UW School of Nursing. We are talking about the lasting impact that childhood trauma can have on children at the time and as they become adults. And Pam, there's actually a system for predicting the risk of damage to mental and physical health. We actually talked about this when WPT's Frederica Freiberg did a documentary about trauma-informed care, and that is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scoring. Can you tell us more about that system?
Yeah, so it's the classic example of things that take 20 years to get into practice of research. So 1998 was the original ACE study, came out and said, wow, when bad things happen to kids throughout the whole course of their life, we can predict poor health outcomes. Some of it are behavioral, smoking, addiction, drinking, suicidality, but some are related to that inflammatory response and epigenetic response. So we see more autoimmune disorders, we see more cancers, we see a six-fold increase in heart disease. And that study has been replicated over and over and over again. Sometimes they've looked at different bad things to happen to children, sometimes looked at different health outcomes. And so the latest thing I've read from the CDC doesn't even bother to quantify what it was exactly or how many times it happened or where, at what point in your life it happened, whether you're 3 or you're 15, but when a significant traumatic effect or a condition impact or hits you as a kid, when you get to 4 or more, you really see the impacts through your life.
And it also seems that whether it, like the children in Frederica Freiberg's documentary, The Young People, whether it was that they were physically abused, sexually abused, moved among many different foster families, separated from their parents, or if it's maybe some of these children who are coming to the southern border who are escaping violent societies and perhaps have also incurred trauma on their journey, it sounds like all of this, it's a cumulative effect.
Yeah. Trauma on top of trauma, for some reason, tends to do more damage. And it makes sense. You don't have time to heal from one and another happens. I read a really moving statement today that immigrant children, you know, these little ones who are mostly coming out of the Northern Triangle in Central America, are 80% are fleeing violence. So it's trauma on top of trauma. And, you know, it just keeps that amygdala, hippocampus, all our endocrine system ramped up. And so already really vulnerable. And then if you remove that safe adult from them forcibly, put them in conditions that are really cold, don't feed them well, expose them to illness, it really sets them up for failure.
So this ACE score, the Adverse Childhood Experiences score, shows kind of the accumulated trauma effect. Is having a high ACE score you know, kind of a sentence that you can't escape, or are there things that people can do to recover?
And I maintain not. I mean, I actually, it's harder to undo what was done to you as a little one under the age of five. But we know that the epigenetic switches are plastic, and so they can be changed. So, you know, I say it somewhat facetiously, mindfulness, kale, and love. But human connections, learning to self-regulate, having some sort of exposure to tamp down that immune system, so doing some work can undo it. But, you know, whenever I can prevent it, that's always where I'm going to go.
And briefly, Pam, before we let you go, a term or a concept that I'm familiar with is secondary trauma. And so what about people who are perhaps working in those centers where the children are being held, or even people who are seeing the images? We did a segment not that long ago about the issue of separation, and a woman said on Facebook she was sobbing telling her husband about it because she saw a child who was the same age as their child. What about this ripple effect of trauma?
All right. I mean, it is, the community impacts are of concern to me. I don't want to tell people to look away, because I think we need to look at this right now and acknowledge it. It's just so easy to get buried in the news cycle or have it be too painful to pay attention to. But I'm really concerned that this could go on or become really a national shame for us. It doesn't make us safer if we're inflicting damage on children that doesn't allow them to attach. It creates adults who don't attach or have empathy. I'm also concerned about people who are working in these camps that, you know, they're not all bad people, and I don't want to vilify them. And that would be miserable to me to be in a camp. I know a pediatrician who goes down and serves at the border and just testified before Congress. And she reported that they're often not allowed to touch the children. That would be really difficult. And so I worry about that. I worry about children who are in this country legally and families that look like those kids and are concerned every day about being swept up in this.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for coming in and sharing that with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's Pam McGranahan, a nurse practitioner and director of the UW Doctor of Nursing Practice Program. We talked with her about the effects childhood trauma can have later in life and what can be done about it. Coming up, we'll talk about what counts as a human right, with the U.S. State Department looking to reexamine that concept. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up Monday after 7:30 on The Morning Show, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins Kate Archer Kent to discuss his first 6 months in office and thoughts on the final state budget. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. State Department announced a new commission this week that's going to take a closer look at the meaning of unalienable rights. The term probably sounds familiar because you can find it in many of our founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the meaning of unalienable rights has gotten confused over time. Here he is talking to reporters about the commission on Monday.
We must, therefore, be vigilant that human rights discourse not be corrupted or hijacked or used for dubious or malignant purposes. It's a sad commentary on our times that more than 70 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, gross violations continue throughout the world, sometimes even in the name of human rights.
Bernadette Myler is a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law and joins us now. Bernadette, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what is the line you think that Secretary of State Pompeo is trying to draw between natural or God-given rights and ad hoc rights?
It's a very interesting commission that he's set up. He wants to reaffirm unalienable rights from the Declaration of Independence. And we might recall that the Declaration protects certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and states that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And what he wants to do is have a return to the founding era and the founding documents of the United States, as opposed to the understanding of human rights through the international community. Now, there are a number of kinds of international human rights that have risen mostly during the 20th century, and the history on the rise of human rights is contested. someone like Sam Moyne argues that it only came up in the 1970s, that human rights really only became something to be reckoned with in the 1970s. Other people date it to the 1940s. Most people don't really think of the Declaration as articulating human rights rather than natural rights of persons. Now, the distinction that Secretary Pompeo seems to want to draw is between certain kinds of unalienable rights, like the ones protected in the Declaration, and more recently recognized rights, like social and economic rights. For example, the right to work, or the right to a home, or rights to same-sex marriage. The other kinds of rights that might also be at issue here are rights of religion. I think that there may be ways in which the founding era or returning to the founding era would suggest a more thoroughgoing emphasis on religious liberty rights than some of the more recent human rights documents. Another issue may also be about the articulation of state sovereignty as opposed to human rights. So he seems to be drawing a line between unalienable rights and rights that government can opt to protect. So what some of the members of the commission that he set up have defended governments like those of Saudi Arabia or of Turkey against claims that they are violating human rights. And this commission may, in fact, support certain governments that other nations might think are violating human rights.
Well, and that leads to the question of how the announcement of the formation of this commission has been received both at home and abroad. What kind of responses have you seen?
I've seen fairly critical responses to the commission. I think that there's a concern that a lot of the members of the commission are people who have a strong history of supporting religious liberty, but not other forms of human rights recognized by the international law community in the 20th century. Marianne Glendon, who is the director of the committee, the chair of the committee, is a very respected scholar from Harvard, but is thought of as someone who has affirmed religious liberty rights, but has been somewhat skeptical of other kinds of welfare-oriented rights or socially-oriented human rights.
And often there are words that may have started with a very specific meaning, say a legal meaning, and are used in everyday conversation. And we do use them in maybe not exactly the precise ways that they started out with. So what is legally, what is a right?
A right, there are actually several ways of thinking about rights. And part of that, the diversity of meanings of rights actually is part of the argument. So a right can either be a natural right that's retained against any government, or it can be a right that is given up in service of a particular social organization. So one of the arguments about human rights is that those are rights that are retained against any government. Someone like the philosopher Thomas Hobbes would have said there's only one right that people don't give up when they enter into society, and that's the right of self-preservation. So a right is some kind of claim to freedom or to a gift from government or some kind of endowment from government. And in general, the U.S. Constitution has been thought to protect negative rights or negative liberties, meaning they protect against government interference. But other kinds of constitutions, especially those that protect social or economic rights, tend to be supporting various functions of society. So there's a right to education. That's a right that government has to provide rather than something that a person is free from within government.
We're talking with Bernadette Myler right now. She's a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. And we're talking about a new panel that the U.S. State Department has put together to reexamine the definition of unalienable rights. And Bernadette, has this been attempted before? Have there been other efforts since, you know, the use of those words a couple centuries ago to redefine or update or take back to original meaning?
Definitely. There have been many attempts to redefine unalienable rights. In fact, one could argue that the redefinition project has been present from the very beginning. One notable aspect of the Declaration is that it was often taken, even from very shortly after the founding moment and ratification of the Constitution, as an unfulfilled promise. So especially abolitionists, those who were trying to abolish slavery before the Civil War, latched on to the Declaration and the Declaration of Unalienable Rights in the Declaration as something that the Constitution had failed to realize, that the Constitution, because it was a pro-slavery document, because it had various compromises in it that allowed for slavery, hadn't lived up to the idea that everyone, every person, has certain unalienable rights. And so the Declaration was used very extensively before the Civil War on behalf of the freedom of those who had been enslaved. So that was kind of the first instance of the effort to use the Declaration in ways that would maybe go against some of the other founding documents. And then also, it's not exactly the Declaration, but in the Constitution, there have been updatings of rights. So the main way in which the Constitution has been interpreted to protect rights, or what people would think of as human rights in the international community, is through the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which gives every person the equal protection of the laws and also allows every person due process. And so the due process clause of the 14th Amendment is where we get, for example, the right to make a decision on abortion, or the right to be free from excessive medical intervention, or other forms of rights. And there have been a lot of contests about what those rights actually include. There was an argument that they should include a right to education. That hasn't been as successful as claims for other kinds of rights.
Is it sometimes a debate between perspectives where looking at whether something is actually a right or if it's a privilege? Because I'm thinking of things like there are some who will say healthcare is a human right, and others will say healthcare is a privilege if you pay for it, if you work for it, if it's provided to you and you take advantage of it. So is that kind of the dichotomy between a privilege and a right?
Definitely. And I think you're exactly right about where this commission is going. What Secretary Pompeo suggested in his statement announcing it was that there was a concerning blurring of the distinction between unalienable rights and ad hoc rights granted by governments. I think those ad hoc rights granted by governments that he was referring to are exactly what you would be calling a privilege. So a lot of the argument about human rights right now is to what extent social rights and economic rights are privileges as opposed to unalienable rights. And traditionally, the United States hasn't respected those kinds of rights as part of its constitutional scheme. So in a way, this commission is trying to defend the American conception of rights as against the international human rights conception of rights.
There's concern in some quarters that this panel might be used to try to deprioritize protections for LGBTQ individuals abroad. Can you connect the dots for us? How would that happen?
Definitely. So one interesting point of background here is that a lot of the Supreme Court decisions that led up to the decision that same-sex marriage is constitutionally protected were reliant in large part on Justice Kennedy, who recently retired and was replaced by Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Kennedy was very influenced by international human rights documents. So he was one of the only more conservative members of the court who really looked to international law for guidance. And he looked to it in the death penalty context. He looked to it in the context of same-sex rights. So one of the things that happened fairly recently on the Supreme Court was the constitutionalization of same-sex marriage through the 14th Amendment of the Constitution again. Now, that was partly relying on these international human rights protections for anyone getting married, for anyone being able to enter into same-sex relationships. Now, I think that one of the concerns here, because the commission is so reliant on people coming from religious backgrounds who have been sometimes critics of same-sex marriage, including Marianne Glendon herself, there's a concern that that will mean that the commission comes out with a declaration that LGBTQ rights are not protected in the same way as the unalienable rights that the commission is going to protect.
We're talking about the term unalienable rights, what it is historically meant, and a new panel from the U.S. State Department to re-examine the definition. Bernadette Myler is with us. She's a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What does the term unalienable rights mean to you? Do you think our idea of what a human right is should be expanded or grow over time? Or do you think the way we talk about rights now is moving too far away from the core idea of years past? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time after this short break. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with Bernadette Myler, a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. She's with us today to talk about what the term unalienable rights means and how that meaning has changed over time. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you remember learning about unalienable rights in school? Do you think the meaning does need to be clarified? What questions do you have for our guest about what the term means and how that actually impacts you and your protections under the Constitution or how the United States moves abroad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Bernadette, what kind of power does a commission like this have? Does it have a direct impact on policy, or is it likely to support a position that Secretary of State Pompeo and others might be hoping to move on anyway?
I don't think it will have a direct impact on our policy. I think that what this will allow is for the United States to have a justification for resisting certain kinds of rights in the international human rights sphere. Or to be more concrete, right? So if a regime is criticized for violating human rights, if the commission comes out with a report that says that those rights are not unalienable rights, then the Secretary of State can point to the report and say, well, we don't agree with the definition of human rights that these international human rights documents are providing, and instead we're supporting this vision of human rights.
And this is obviously looking at foreign policy, diplomacy, relations with other countries, because it is coming out of the State Department, but is there a possibility that this commission's work and the conclusions that it comes to could be applied in a domestic sense as well?
I think it's unlikely that it will be applied in a domestic context. The background here is that the United States has been fairly resistant to entering into any human rights agreements on the international level. And that's a fairly long-standing resistance, especially under the Bush administration. There was an articulation of a policy to prioritize U.S. sovereignty over international human rights. And in particular, the U.S. refused to enter into the agreement for the International Criminal Court that 123 countries now participate in. So the U.S. has often dissented from international human rights agreements. Now, I think what's new here is basically that Secretary Pompeo is trying to get the commission to come up with a justification for that, and a justification based on U.S. constitutional norms.
And the idea of human rights and promoting human rights abroad, I mean, often the U.S. politicians like to talk about, you know, spreading U.S. values, and often that means, you know, human rights at a higher level. Has it become politicized more recently, or has it always been a politicized issue?
I would say that it's always been a politicized issue. Interestingly, I think the U.S. has promoted U.S. conceptions of freedoms abroad for a long time. There's an interesting set of studies about how the CIA used the First Amendment protections of freedom of speech and freedom of artistic expression during the Cold War to suggest that the United States was better than communist countries. And so the CIA funded Jackson Pollock and other avant-garde artists to show that the U.S. would support even these kind of outrageous methods of artistic expression, or what were considered at the time outrageous methods. So that's one example of a U.S. use politically of human rights. I think that it's possible also that it's being human rights are being used politically by the international community. Certainly, there are different human rights committees that have different views about what's politically desirable. And I think that there is a valid critique from the U.S. standpoint of some international human rights commissions as not sufficiently democratic, that they're rooted in a kind of administrative logic that isn't really democratically legitimate. That's one of the concerns about the International Criminal Court, that it's not supported by some international legislature or other international body that would be able to be more democratically accountable.
And we are, as we can tell from our own conversation here, this is a fairly philosophical topic. How do you think that this commission is going to approach their work? What are they going to be looking at specifically?
I think it's a really good question. One thing I think they will be looking to is going back to the roots of something like the Declaration and unalienable rights in the Declaration. A lot of the members of the commission have a strong background in religion. There are a couple of members who are Catholic, and actually natural rights developed initially out of a Catholic tradition. And so I think they may be going back to those first principles. I think they'll also be looking to a lot of the international documents that are currently in place and the international agreements, and looking at which of those agreements they think really reflect unalienable rights or not. I just want to give maybe two examples of cases that might turn out differently based on the decision of the commission or what the commission comes up with. So one example is felon disenfranchisement. So the U.S. allows for people convicted of felonies not to be able to vote for the rest of their life. It depends on the state, but there are still states that permit this. Now, that's not considered to be in conformity with human rights. The UN Human Rights Committee had a report about 10 years ago claiming that U.S. policies violated international human rights law. I would think that the commission would say that that was not a legitimate unalienable right, so that would be one case that would where the U.S. would resist the norms of the international human rights community. Going the other way is a case involving a family that came from Germany because they weren't allowed to engage in religious homeschooling in Germany, and this happened in about 10 years ago also. And the Romika family wasn't allowed to engage in homeschooling in Germany, and they made an asylum petition on that basis. It wasn't granted by the courts, but ultimately they were allowed to stay by President Obama. But I think that claim of religious liberty might be looked at more favorably under the commission's report, if I'm accurate about how they would come out on this.
And Bernadette, do we have a sense of when we might start seeing anything coming out of this commission? Is there any kind of a timeline in place?
I haven't seen any reports of a timeline, so I'm not sure. I would think it would take at least several months to a year for them to come out with anything.
And we had a question from a listener, Fitzgerald in Prairie du Chien, who said he has heard inalienable rights, spelled I-N, and we've been saying unalienable rights. Are they the same thing?
Yes, they are the same thing. It's spelled unalienable in the Declaration, but basically fungible. Inalienable and unalienable are the same thing.
All right. So a philosophical and grammatical conversation all together. Bernadette, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Bernadette Myler, a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School. She was with us today to talk about a new U.S. State Department effort to look into what the term unalienable rights means. Coming up Monday on Central Time, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, we'll learn more about that milestone through a variety of objects tied to the event. Overall rates of poverty in Wisconsin have fallen, but a growing number of elderly people are struggling to make ends meet. We'll look at why that's happening and what to do about it. We'll get a preview of a Wisconsin conference looking at why making affordable housing available has a much wider impact than we might think. It can affect education, jobs, and more. That's Monday on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Monday after 6:15, in the wake of the iconic Mad Magazine's announcement that, for the most part, it won't be publishing new material, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the current state of political satire. That's Monday morning at 6:15 right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about everything you need to know to pack a great summer picnic. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.